My voice for this talk. Did end up getting sick for this conference. No pun intended. So I'll be talking about unitary designs, and in particular, we're talking about bounds, or how to bound their size. This is joint work with Aidan Roy at the University of Calgary. Aidan Roy did most of the heavy lifting in this work. And we've published, most of the work is archived in this paper here. So there aren't that many papers on unitary designs, so we can actually list them all. As far as I can tell, they were first introduced in Dankert's master's thesis. And then again, in a paper by Dankert, Cleave, Emerson, and Levine. As far as I can tell, this paper hasn't been published yet. I wasn't the referee, if they're listening. And then there's an exhaustive paper by David Gross and co-authors. And I've dabbled in unitary designs in the context of process tomography. There's a paper on approximate unitary two designs. And then there's our paper here. So there aren't that many papers on unitary designs, but you shouldn't be discouraged by that. It's not because they're uninteresting, it's just because, well, the positive side is that there's a lot to be discovered still. So what are unitary designs? So unitary designs are like spherical designs, except that members of the design are elements of the unitary group rather than points on the sphere. There are many formal ways of defining them. Here's one. Let X be a finite subset of the unitary group. Then X is called a unitary T design if it satisfies this equation here. So here we have T tensor products of a unitary matrix with another T tensor products of its complex conjugate. Averaged over the design has to equal the same average but over the entire unitary group. So here this U bar is just the matrix U with all the elements replaced by their complex conjugates. And DU is the unit Haar measure. So the right-hand side here can be evaluated explicitly. It can be evaluated in terms of this so-called Weingarten function in papers by Collins and Zanardi. But it's quite complicated, so we don't usually use this as our means to test whether we have a unitary design or not. And you can see from the definition here that if I have a phase in front of my unitary matrix, I effectively get the same point. So they may have been better defined in terms of a subset of the projective unitary group, but traditionally they're a subset of the unitary group. And we'll follow tradition. Yeah, so this is not Hermitian conjugation. This is
With respect to what basis? There must be a basis in the background.
Yeah, well, this is going to be a standard basis, and this is just a unitary matrix.
Unitary matrix expressed in that standard basis.
Yeah, okay. So think of it as maybe the standard representation of a unitary group element. And this is the reason why I chose U bar. You can define in terms of U dagger as well if you want to get rid of that basis. But I chose U bar because in this case we want to learn about the dual representation, and this is the dual representation. So there's a more traditional way of defining unitary designs in terms of polynomials. So most of design theory is defined in terms of polynomial spaces these days. So web hom RS, or to be explicit, hom UD RS. So the polynomials that are homogeneous of degree R in the matrix element entries of U, and homogeneous of degree S in the matrix entries of U bar. So here's an example. This polynomial is homogeneous of degree 2 in the entries of U, and degree 1 in the entries of U bar, so it's in HOM 2, 1. So here's the traditional definition of a T-design. X is a T-design if for every polynomial in HOM TT, the average of this polynomial over the design is the same as what you get if you average over the entire unitary group. So if we go back to the former definition, you can see that if you think of this huge matrix, all the entries of that matrix are just monomials, which span the space of POM T2 there, and they're the complete basis, but they span the space. So the formal definition is just a compact way of writing this definition here. Now note that if this polynomial is in POM T2, then this factor out the front is in POM 1, 1, so F must be in POM T minus 1, T minus 1. And since this polynomial is exactly 1 on the unitary group, we know that every T design is also a T minus 1 design. So that's a standard property of T designs. If this polynomial here satisfies this equation, so does F, so we have a T minus 1 design as well. So notice that if we're trying to distinguish between unitaries drawn from UD and drawn from X, we'd need a moment function which has order higher than t, since all the other averages are the same. So as t is increased, functions with an increasing finite c or high nonlinearity cannot distinguish unitaries drawn from x from those drawn from the entire unitary group. So that's kind of the motivation of designs in quantum information theory. Now, we can generalize the concept of a design to a weighted T design. These are also called curvature formulas, but you have to be a little careful here because some curvature formulas will have negative weights, so it's more or less a positive weight curvature formula. Or I just call them weighted T designs. So these are just a generalization where you introduce a weight function, W, it's positive, and instead of taking this uniform weight over the design, we take a weighted average. So the weight is chosen positive, so they can be interpreted as a probability density on the design. Of course, every T design is a weighted T design with uniform weight. And it turns out that weighted T designs are much easier to find. So there's a third characterization. This is the same for all designs. Testing whether a weighted set forms a T design can be difficult without this third characterization in terms of the inner products. So here we have a weighted double sum over the inner product values. This theorem is pretty easy to prove, and it's standard based back a long time ago. For any finite subset of UD, say, and any positive normalized weight function, this double sum is bounded below by a positive constant, and we get equality if and only if X is a weighted T design. So the bound here can be evaluated explicitly. It's known it is exactly the number of permutations of 1 up to t, they have no increasing subsequence of length greater than d. So this combinatorial solution was derived by Eric Raines. The case d greater than equal t was derived by Dikernis and Shasha Ani. But the point is, the right hand of the bound is known explicitly. And you can use this as a test to see whether you have a weighted T design or not. Or you can, this is also the frame potential, so we can minimize this if we parameterize a weighted subset of UD to find a T design. So the proof is pretty standard, it's analogous to a proof by Welch for complex vectors. All you do is you construct an operator, which is the difference between what we have and what we want. So if X is a T design, D is exactly 0. Now we just look at the trace of D dagger D, just expand it out. The first term is the double sum we're trying to bound. We have two more integrals, they're in fact exactly the same. If we just change a variable in both of them, we get this integral here, which is our lower bound.
So it's just minus 2 plus 1 is minus 1.
And we know that trace of d dagger d is greater than or equal to 0, and equals 0 if and only if d equals 0, so if and only if we have a t design. So this proof method works for complex projective designs, any design you want. It's all pretty standard. So I guess I should motivate the problem a bit. So why do we want to look at designs? In general, randomness is expensive. It's hard to fake and costly to share. So at any point that we can reduce the randomness for a certain information processing task, we should. So designs allow unitaries drawn from UD to be replaced by those drawn from a finite set. So we reduce the number of random bits to log the number on the set. So one design's depolarized, two designs 12. And the hope also is that the members of X, the design, will be easier to implement than arbitrary unitaries. And this seems to be the case for a lot of examples. So for any example in the context of state estimation, designs reduce the optimal covariant measurement to a simpler one. So there are two scenarios which I know of. State T designs realize the optimal measurements for the Massa propensity state estimation problem. And state and unitary two designs realize optimal measurements for state and process tomography. So two designs are useful in general, but as a means to de-randomize certain tasks. So the question we want to answer in this talk is how big do unitary t-designs have to be? So I've gone through what they are. We'll go through the complex projective case. So by the complex projective case, I mean state designs. I think when we call them spherical designs, it's kind of a misnomer. Spherical designs are usually the real sphere. And most mathematicians call what we call state designs, complex projective designs. So we'll go into the complex projective case, and then we'll apply the same methods to the unitary case. We'll derive lower bounds. We'll ask questions of whether these bounds can be met. And in the process, we'll look at what will be analogous to sick PODMs and MUVs for the unitary case. There's a way of deriving upper bounds, and we'll look at constructions. Please interrupt me whenever you want, because you know how understandable this all is. So these are standard methods dating from Galsati, Gottfels, and Seidel. They were generalized by Neumeier in 1981. He generalized them to these things called Galsati spaces, which include the projective spaces. An interesting fact is that Arnold Neumeier is the thesis advisor of Zollner. That was then generalized to some extent by Chris Godsell, who's at the University of Waterloo, to polynomial spaces. And they were generalized again by a Russian, Levenstein, to any compact metric space. So you were asking before, Martin. Whether there were constructions of prime power MUVs before Woods and Fields, and unfortunately, Levenstein seems to have discovered them around 82 or 83. I think it was for odd prime powers, but the paper is in Russian, so I have no way of confirming it. The only way I confirm it is by looking at his later papers, and he cites himself as the discoverer, along with Holtop for the odd prime.
Was it by any chance with the Kapatyansky, Levenstein Kapatyansky?
I think it's a single author papers. Yes. So Levenstein did a lot of work in the Soviet Union parallel to Sartre. And he has a huge monograph on designs and weighted designs. So here's the complex projective case. We've seen this definition before, probably, many times before. A weighted complex projective T design. It's a subset. It's a set of complex vectors in dimension V, which satisfies this equation here. So here I've rewritten it in a way analogous to the unitary case. So V is just a column vector, say, and V is the same vector where you take the complex conjugates of the matrix elements. Now, if you look at this definition, you can always just reshape this big long column vector into an outer product. So for any R plus S equal to T, I can just rewrite this definition in terms of this other one, which is just an outer product. And then you see straight away that the span of these vectors, V to the R, tensor with V bar to the S, is independent of whether V is chosen from the design or the entire space. So the span of these vectors is simply the support of this operator here, which we can work out. So the number of these vectors must be bigger than the dimension of this space. And that's just a standard method for lower bounding T designs. So the dimension of this space is known in terms of this dual space. So the dimension of the span of these vectors is known in terms of home CV RS, say. It's the space of polynomials that are homogeneous with degree R and the matrix entries of V, homogeneous with degree S and the entries of V bar. It has dimension here. And so we know that any weighted T design, well, for any weighted T design, its size must be bigger than the dimension of this space for any R plus S equal to T. And you get the best lower bound when R and S are roughly equal. There's also a standard way of getting upper bound, and this applies to any weighted T design. You use methods from convexity. And here's the answer. We'll see it in the unitary design case. So for the questions we're thinking about, we weighted two designs have, well, there exists a weighted two design with size between d squared and d squared times d plus 1 squared and 4. And the question that we want to answer is whether we can get down to d squared. So only stick POVMs can saturate this lower bound in this case. So what we do is we just apply the same tricks to the unitary design case. A weighted unitary T design satisfies for any R plus S equal T, this equation here. So in this case, I've rewritten our matrices in terms of vectors just by backing them, say. We have an outer product integrated across the entire unitary group. And I'm just going to call this operator B. You can think of it as a super operator if you want. And the way we vector these operator means that our vector inner product is just a Hilbertian inner product. So therefore, the number of elements of a unitary T design must be bounded away by either the rank of this operator, dimension of the span of these unitary matrices here, or dimension of the dual space of polynomials. So in the paper, we worked it out in terms of dimension of this space, which happens to be known in terms of an associative algebra called the shared rational algebra. Though there are only a couple of papers, and very recent papers on this algebra. They don't quite work out the dimension exactly. So we have to do some work in this case. But in this talk, I'm being crazy, and I'm going to just work out the rank of this super operator. So there's an easy way of getting a rough bound, and you can do it in terms of just the positive eigenvalues of this Hermitian operator. Just think of the convexity of the function x squared. Look at this inequality here. We know that the average of these positive numbers squared must be less than or equal to the average of their squares, just by convexity. And looking at the right-hand side here, we have the trace of this operator squared divided by n squared. The trace is easy to work out. It's just d to the 2t. On this side, we have the trace of b squared divided by n. The trace of b squared, you can work it out pretty quickly. It happens to be our lower bound that we saw for the inner product test. And it's always bounded above by t factorial. So straight away, we have a lower bound. the number of elements for our designs are bounded below by d of the 2t on t factorial. So that's a very rough and dirty way of getting a lower bound. It's actually the best we'll see asymptotically. So if you want a more precise bound, we need to work out the rank of this super operator precisely. And we can do that using representation theory. So I took a crash course in representation theory before it came out, and so correct me if I get something wrong. Let R, it's a fixed matrix, take our UD representation where we have R copies of the standard representation and S copies of the dual representation. Let R take it to its irreducible decomposition. Where, so rows, these are unitary matrices, they're irreps. They act on a space V mu, and which has dimension D mu and occurs in the multiplicity mu in this decomposition. So now to find another super operator which acts in this way, and we can just apply R on both sides of V to effectively diagonalize it, and we get this operator here. So what I'll do is I'll look at the, this is like a huge matrix, and I'm going to look at all the blocks. So all the blocks are in this form here. If I get rid of that basis and this basis, they look like that. I look at these blocks in terms of the matrix component basis for our operator space. So it turns out by Schur's cardinality of matrix components, we have this equality right here. So we've just got our block in terms of the matrix component basis, which when you plug in what the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product is, you get the matrix elements, which are orthogonal by Schur. So we know straight away that each of these blocks is either zero if we have a different representation, if mu is not equal to nu, or just the identity on our space for operators if nu equals nu. So immediately we have diagonalized our super operator, and we can just read off the rank. The rank is just the sum of the dimensions of our spaces squared. So you get something else for free when you do it this way. And if you take the trace of B squared now, you get exactly, we already saw that the trace of B squared is this integral that we were trying to work out before. And we've effectively found out what it is. It's the sum of the squares and multiplicities for any r cross s equal to t. So you get that free, but what we were after was the rank of this super operator. But we still need to answer the question of how do these representations decompose. And luckily, I could have done it myself, it's already worked out. So the irreps of UD are labeled by non-increasing integer partitions of length d. Their dimension is known in terms of Weyl's dimension formula. We need to introduce some more notation to state the result. So let mu plus be the subsequence of positive integers in mu, and let, say, mod mu be the sum of all the integers. So for example, here's an integer partition which labels an irrep. The integers sum to minus 1, mu plus is just 1, 1, and the positive entries sum to 2. So we can get a combinatorial solution to the decomposition of u tends to r, u bar tends to s. This was worked out by Stembridge and also Banker pretty recently, but I guess it's effectively in all the theory. The point is that the decomposition of this representation is known explicitly in terms of this formula here. So we can state the final result. So for any weighted T design, for any R plus S equal to T, the size of this T design is bounded below the dimension of the space, which is known explicitly. So it's still, you don't see much there unless we work out explicitly what the dimensions of these spaces are. So let's look at some examples. But again, the best bounds come when R and S are roughly halfway. So when we can make them on T on 2. So from now on, I'm going to assume that mu is decomposition, or mu labels the decomposition. The choices are C on T on 2 and S on C, floor of T on 2. For small t, we recover some of the known bounds. So as a trivial bound for one designs. For the bound worked out by David Gross and co-workers for the two designs. And then we can keep going up. We can look at the bounds for three designs, four designs, and five designs. So it becomes a bit hairy when d is less than t, because you don't have the entire sum in these decompositions. But whenever the dimension is bigger than t, we get a nice simple formula for the lower bound. So I guess that's the main result of that paper. Now we want to ask questions like, are these bounds actually optimal? Can we saturate them? Well, we won't do that just yet. There's also a rough way of getting another lower bound, and it comes from choosing R as T and S equals 0. And then you get a nice formula for the dimension of this polynomial space, from which you can read off the asymptotics. We get the same asymptotics as we saw before, fixed D. And we get another lower bound on the size of unitary designs for fixed D. It's interesting that in the qubit case, when D is 2, you can find constructions which meet this asymptotic lower bound.
For D equals 2.
D equals 2, sorry. So there are upper bounds of order T cubed in that case, explicit constructions. Okay, so let's see if we can meet these lower bounds. So a design that meets the bound is called type. So in this case, we have the number of design elements is exactly the dimension of our polynomial space. And these are interesting because whenever you meet a lower bound, it enforces a lot of structure on the design. So we can derive this structure pretty easily, just following a standard method. Let's construct some complex vector space of dimension given by the size of our design. And we'll label a standard basis for this complex vector space by the elements of our design. And now we'll construct another basis and label it by ij and mu. So it's the basis f. And it's defined in terms of polynomials, f, ij, mu, mu. And these polynomials are just the matrix elements of our representation matrices. It turns out we saw before by sheer orthogonality that these polynomials form an orthonormal basis for our polynomial space on T on 2, T on 2. And so they also form a basis for our complex vector space here. And you can show that explicitly. Just work out what their overlap is. Just plugging in the definition, we get this sum here. And you can see straight away that because f, I, j, and u is in HOM T on 2, T on 2, this polynomial here is in HOM T, T. So I can replace this weighted sum by the integral over entire unitary group using the property of that x as a design. And by sheer orthogonality, this is delta mu, mu, delta ik, delta jl. So this is another basis for our space. So what we've done here is we've effectively found a unitary matrix which takes us from one basis to another. We already know that the columns are orthogonal. We're going to use the fact that now the rows are orthogonal to derive conditions on type designs. So we also know that because the X are an orthonormal basis for the space, that they have this resolution of unity. So let's see what this gives us. Acting on both sides by our standard basis, we know that delta mu nu, delta mu b, equals
plugging in what it is, plugging in our definition of our new basis, we get a sum over polynomials, and plug in what our definition of our polynomials were, we get this other sum, which depends on the matrix components of our theorems. And we see straight away that we have a sum over I and J right in here, so we have an identity there and there. It's just a trace of one Irrup matrix against another. And because they are representations, it's also a trace of rho mu u dagger v, and that is in fact the character for our representation. Plugged in there. And the character is already known in terms of shared polynomials. So we have a set of mod x squared conditions on our type designs. So let's look at what these conditions mean. If we choose u equals v, so we look at the diagonal entries, plugging that in, we mean 1 equals this sum over here, which is the sum over the character evaluated at the identity, which is just d mu. So we get sum over d mu squared, which is the size of x. So our first condition is that whenever these bounds are met, the weighted design has to be actually unweighted, so our weights are uniform. These are the other tightness conditions here. And in fact, you can go the other direction, so you can show that these conditions are sufficient and necessary for a weighted set of that size to be a T design. So let's look at the one design case. In this case, the decomposition contains only the standard error. It has dimension D, the character is just the trace. So we know straight away that when U is not equal to V, the trace of G dagger against V has to be 0. So these are, of course, the unitary operator bases which exist in every dimension. So we know that we can saturate the bound when T equals 1.
Quick question about this unweighted result. Is that true for vector?
It's a general property.
General property.
It's in Lavenstein's paper, any compact metric space. So
whenever you meet the bound.
Whenever you meet the bound, it has to be unweighted.
Yes.
So this is actually a very, very complicated way of deriving the fact that fourth normal operator bases are unitary one designs. But we know that we can now step up T and look at the other conditions. Let's look at two designs. In this case, the representation decomposes into two Irrups, just a trivial representation, which has dimension 1, and another representation, which has dimension D squared minus 1. And this is the character for this particular representation, which we can just now rearrange, and we get straight away that type unitary two designs have to be equiangular with this particular overlap. So again, this is analogous to the sick POEMs, but for unitary designs. So the type unitary two designs, if they were to exist, would define a sick POEM for, which is information complete for this operator subspace, defined by taking the convex combinations of maximally entangled states, so it's a special subspace of the Bloch sphere, defined as the convex hull of maximally entangled states. And these POEMs would be optimal for certain system process tomography of unit channels. Unfortunately, it turns out they don't seem to exist. You can prove, or it has been proven already, that they do not exist for U2. So in the case of unitary two designs in dimension 2, the lower bound can't be met. And it seems we've done some computer searches and it seems that they don't exist in general. So we're not too confident at all that type two designs exist for any t greater than 1, which is unfortunate, but even in the complex case, you don't get equality at t equal to 4 and above, and at t equals 3, there's only 3 known examples of equality. So we shouldn't expect too much. Let's move on.
I'm curious how this works. How do you show non-existence in case U2? How does this intuitively on?
Oh, in this case, U2?
Right.
We'll see later on that you can just map straight onto real projective designs.
Okay.
This
PR4
is isomorphic to U2, and then you just mine the results that are already known out there. So if we can't achieve these bounds absolutely, let's see if we can do it asymptotically. So let's look for asymptotically tight two designs. So far, the most efficient constructions of unitary two designs that we know of are exactly the projective Clifford group. It has dimension d to the 5 minus d cubed in prime power dimensions. It has psi as d to the 5 minus d cubed in prime power dimensions. But that size is a factor of d above what we know as the lower bound. So either this lower bound is not asymptotically tight, or there's another family out there. So it's a general open problem. I think it's a pretty important open problem whether we can find a family of unitary two designs which saturate this bound asymptotically. So in the complex projective case, the lower bound is d squared, of course, and it's saturated by a complete family of knobs. Layered size d squared plus d in prime power dimensions. So we already have the complex projective case right there. The obvious question is whether there exists mutually unbiased unitary bases, or MOOCs, as David and Aidan and I are calling them, if that's okay. So two bases, UK and VK, are mutually unbiased. It's completely analogous to the state case if their Hilbert Schmidt inner product is 1 for all J and K. So there are a lot of analogies to the state case. There can be at most d squared minus 1 pairwise mutually unbiased bases in the unitary group. So to show this, you can define an embedding into a real vector space of dimension d squared minus 1 squared. And you do that by first mapping a unitary matrix onto a maximum tangent state, and then subtract off the identity, get rid of a dimension. And you can see straight away, if I rewrite this out into a basis of traces Hermitian operators, it has dimension d squared minus 1 all squared. So a unitary basis then specifies the vertices of a regular simplex in the d squared minus 1 dimensional subspace of this big space that it spans. You can see it's not d squared because if I sum up this for basis elements, I get 0. So it's going to be at least, it's going to be no more than d squared minus 1. And the fact that it forms a simplex means it actually spans the subspace. So this is analogous to the way that Wouters showed that there are at most d plus 1 mutually unbiased bases for state designs. Mutually unbiased unitary bases, U and V correspond to orthogonal subspaces in this real vector space. You can see that just by working out what the overlaps are, of which there can be at most the dimension of our real vector space divided by d squared minus 1, many. So we get back d squared minus 1. So that's kind of interesting. And also, the union of d squared, just in the state case, the union of d squared minus 1 moves is an unweighted two design. So it has size d to the 4 minus d squared, which is going to be asymptotically tight. And you can show this just by the inner product test. You can do it in your head if you want. You just work out all the inner products and you show that it equals t factorial, which is 2 in this case. And in fact, these are the unique minimal two designs that consist of entirely of unitary bases. So it's not too hard to prove that if we have any subset of the unitary group, which is a union of a family of m unitary operator bases, then X is a weighted two design where the weight is assumed constant across members of the same basis. sorry, if X is a weight of two design where the weight is assumed constant across members of the same basis, then M must be greater or equal to D squared minus one, with equality only if X is the union of a complete set of M UVs, or MUVs, and the weight is constant. So they're kind of an analogy of sick PODMs, but where you have this restriction that your design is consisting of orthonormal measurements, say. So, of course, the next obvious question is, do they exist? And, well, yes, they do, at least in some dimensions. They're known in dimensions 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, in special subgroups of the projective Clifford group. And they were discovered by Chow in 2005, and he doesn't call them MOOBs at all. So you can, there's a paper on the process tomography where you can read about MOOBs. So it's an open problem to find more MOOBs if they were to exist. It turns out that you can't, so these special subgroups were minimal transitive subgroups of the symplectic group SP2PDM, I got that right. And it turns out that Chow cannot prove, sorry, that Chow proved that they could not exist in other dimensions. So if you were to construct more MOOBs, you'd have to use some kind of other construction, or maybe a purely algebraic construction. If you're interested, I can say more about our ideas. It's joint work with Dave Gross and Aidan Roy. So let's move on. Unfortunately, we haven't answered the question of tightness, so it's a pretty important open problem, I think. You should think about it if you can. But let's consider upper bounds now. Now, there's a general theorem which applies to all two designs. This applies to more than two designs. It applies to what are called averaging sets. It's by Seymour and Zabrowski. It says that for any T and D, and all sufficiently large n, there exists an unweighted unitary T design, in this special case, of size given by n. So it's actually a pretty important result. It's hard to prove because the designs are assumed unweighted. And it tells you that if the size is large enough, you'll always see T designs. It doesn't tell you how big you have to go before you start seeing them. If you relax to weight designs, then there's an easy way of getting upper bound. So we have a theorem in our paper that for any T and D, there exists a weighted T design in UD of size given by the dimension of form TT. So this is of order G to the 4T. And the proof is standard. We can go through it. The first thing you do is you construct an operator A, which is kind of like a Barrett center. It's just the average, what we want, average of the unitary matrices, like this. And then we consider vectors, U tend to T, U bar tend to T minus this matrix. You consider them as vectors. And if you do a uniform sum over the entire unitary group, you get the origin. So I subtracted off A, so I would get the origin here. And so we know that the origin is in the convex hull of these vectors. So there's a theorem in convex analysis that there now exists a finite subset of these vectors, which also includes zero in its convex hull. And that means there exists some positive weights for which these vectors sum to zero, which, once we rearrange, is our condition for a weighted T design. And moreover, the size of the new set can be chosen with a size given by or bounded above by the real dimension of the span of this space of these vectors. You have to believe me what the dimension is. It's just dimension of POM TT minus one. All I did here was just move in a fine space down into the origin so it's a real thing. So it's a proper vector space. Apply this theorem. And there's your answer. So here's our upper bound. Like, we know for sure that there will exist a unitary T-zone. It turns out you can decrease by one again because this set here is connected. You can do that in your head, why that should be the case. So we have an upper bound. Now let's just think about constructions. So all of the known non-trivial constructions come from finite groups. And these were discovered by David Gross in his long paper. So let rho be a unitary representation of some finite group G. So it satisfies the group relations. We can then test whether the image of rho is a T-zone in terms of the character alone. We just rewrite our inner product test in terms of characters. So if G is a finite group and rho is a representation of character chi, and the image here is unitary T-zone, if and only if we sum over this as its character, we get this integral here, which we've been seeing a lot of. So it tells you that all you need is the character to figure out whether this representation is a unitary T-zone. It's quite useful because now you can mine the known representations of finite groups. So this is all in David Gross's paper. X is a one design if and only if rho is irreducible. So you can get rid of all the non-irreducible, the reducible F representations. And this is just a property of Schur's normality. Some of the multiplicities of your representation squared has to be one, so there must be only one of them given this condition. So we can restrict to irreducible representations, and in that case, the center just consists of the identities, there's some phases. So we can mod out the center and think of it, say, as a projective representation, and we reduce the size of our design in that way. And we can now harvest unitary designs from character tables. So mostly stolen from David Gross's paper. I guess I could go on forever in this table. Here's our Clifford group designs. The moods given by these Chow subgroups. So we have them in dimension 2, 3, 5, 7 and 11. David Gross found another subgroup, of, in this case SB43, which gives you unitary 2 design in dimension 9. So I've marked all the higher order designs in different colors. The blues are the 3 design, and there's only one example of a 5 design or a higher order design in dimension. It exists in dimension 2. And you can see that some of these bounds are just completely off. So some of these sides are completely off the level bound. So, well, that's disgusting, really. So that's pretty much what we know. I did say in dimension 2, you can map the problem to real projective design. So let's just look at that. And all those designs before were unweighted. So we expect that weighted designs should be easy to find, so it's going to start finding them. So U2 T designs are exactly equivalent to real projective T designs in 4 dimensions through this isomorphism. And so you can just now mine all the real projective designs, and you get another list of examples. So in this case, this is our standard lower bound. Because real projective designs are studied much more, there's known better lower bounds, and there are constructions. Most of these constructions are weighted designs, because weighted designs outperform unweighted designs usually, except for some special cases, like in our 5 design, so on the previous slide, is actually optimal, and it's an unweighted design, probably. The optimal U2 design is in fact a weighted design. It has 11 elements. Then there are plenty of other examples. And I mentioned before that Shemi Sieve has constructions of K Gauss constructions of antipodal spherical designs, which map into real projective designs, and then into unitary designs, which give you order T cubed, an order T cubed family of designs. So asymptotically, the entire story is known in the qubit case. So conclusions. Unitary designs are new and they're interesting, and there's much to be discovered. The law of bound method of Del Sarte and co-workers has been extended now to the unitary case. But efficient constructions of unitary designs remain elusive. There are some open questions. Have all examples of complete sets of NUVs already been discovered? And is there a family of unitary two designs? If not, is there a family of unitary two designs of the optimal asymptotic science? Okay, thanks.
So, any questions? Has this last item been established for a weighted case?
No. It's just, I was using two designs in generic sense in this, right. So
okay.
Even with weighted, even with weighted designs, we don't know how if we can saturate this law bound.
We can find certain approximate unitary two designs to satisfy that. Writing down it.
Do they even go under this bound?
No.
Okay.
Well, is this Rubenstein that a randomized construction will only certainly saturate?
So that's Aaron's construction? It's not at all up to me.
Okay.
Write down explicit.
It's explicit.
Okay.
So he's proving actually random efficient.
Random efficient is not.
So if true. You're in that method, if it's not efficient, then maybe it's. I'm not quite sure. It might be certainly much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay, well, that's great.
I have a question.